energy and stuff, or how to live happy lives in a growth-constrained future. This audiobook is provided by IIER. Visit www.energyandstuff.org to learn more. Chapter 1. Incomes have recently peaked for most people. Less than 100 years ago, if you had asked a random person where they had grown up, over half would have answered, on a farm. Today, you are lucky ever to get that reply, as only 1 in 50 people works in agriculture in most advanced economies. Had you further asked those farmers back then what decided if you were rich or poor, they would have been quick to say that the size of your land and its soil mattered most, and how many good hands, oxen, and horses were available to work that land. They too might have mentioned the weather, the right amount of sunlight and water, the absence of pests, and maybe your capability to store and sell your crops. Economic textbooks back then said the same as the farmers. Today, for most of us, our lives revolve around other things. We work in offices or factories, or provide services to people who work in offices and factories. And even if we are one of those rare farmers, what matters most has changed altogether. Farmers work with machines and computers like everyone else, and run their farms pretty much like any other business. Grain yields per acre have increased massively. For example, corn harvest per acre grew sixfold between 1930 and 2010. If they industrially farm fruit and vegetables in a greenhouse, neither the acreage of their land nor the amount of sunlight or rain matter much, just the size of the factory and how well they manage their growing conditions and avoid pests. Why has all this changed completely? Why have we seemingly become so independent from land, sunlight, and water to go about our lives? Commonly, this change is attributed to the Industrial Revolution, specifically the introduction of technology to do things more easily that previously required a lot of manual or animal labor, which brought us luxuries our ancestors never had, such as cars, airplanes, and smartphones. This process started about 250 years ago by introducing steam engines in England and has since spread to every single corner of our planet. We would rather label it the Energy Revolution. But let's first take a brief history tour. We begin with the year 1800, 13 years after the Constitution was born. For most people, little had changed for centuries except for the place they lived. About 75% of Americans were farmers, working their land with draft animals in their bare hands. A few steam engines had appeared in coal mines and factories, but there were no railroads yet, no electricity, and not much else resembling today's advanced societies. Parts of Europe and the newly born United States of America were, like today, among the richest places around the world. However, rich back then meant that an average person's income was about $2,500 in 2015 dollars. That is, a little more than $200 a month. Can you imagine living off $200? You have to travel far into the poorer regions of Africa or Asia to find countries with similar per capita incomes today. Just as a comparison, a full 1,800 years earlier, in ancient Rome around 1 AD, average incomes were around $1,500, only 40% less. Such little progress for such a long time. Fast track to the year 1950. The average U.S. income had experienced a sevenfold increase. Everything we know today was showing up. Cars, planes, TVs, telecommunications, the first computers, and modern farming. Feeding more people per acre than ever before. However, farmers still made up over 12% of the workforce, as many still worked the way they had for centuries, without much machinery. Another jump forward by 50 years to the year 2000, and within those short 50 years, per capita income had tripled again, and we had reached a peak of human economic success for almost everyone in the country. By then, the average American's income was 21 times that of 200 years prior when adjusted for inflation. And the good part was that lower incomes had participated more than anybody else in this rise, making each person the richest person in history within their income range. The entire world participated in the same growth story, often a little later and less pronounced, or starting from lower levels. From 1820 to 2010, within less than 200 years, Global per capita income grew 11 times in inflation-adjusted dollars, while the world's population increased from roughly 1 billion to 7 billion people within the same period. In other words, the entire global economic output is now 77 times bigger than it used to be 200 years ago. Many more people live on our planet, and much more wealth is now available for almost each and every one of them. But then, during the past 15 years, this amazing pattern started to break. It began with low-income earners in advanced economies, and more recently hit almost everyone except for the ominous top 1%. Between the year 2000 and 2014, all but the richest households saw their inflation-adjusted incomes shrink in the U.S. Let's try to dive a little deeper into that. Households at the top of the lowest quintile, meaning that 20% of households make less and 80% earn more, have seen their inflation-adjusted annual income shrink by 14% between the years 2000 and 2014, throwing them back to the levels of 1974. Households at the 60% mark, which means that 40% have a higher income than them, lost 8% in those 13 years, pushing their incomes back to that of 1995. Only households above the 95% level have seen a rise, at least on paper. The year 2015 has seen a slight rise for most thanks to lower resource prices, but unfortunately, this benefit isn't here to stay. What is particularly remarkable, this decline partially took place during a recovery period after the so-called Great Recession, following the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, despite feverish attempts of governments and central banks to restart the economy, ranging from deficit spending, economic stimulus, to the lowest interest rates in history. This new dynamic is puzzling everyone, but we will explain in the next two chapters how we have more or less used up the easily accessible natural resources on our planet with no good replacements in sight, and are now working our way through the hard-to-get ones, which makes things much more difficult. Chapter 2. Drivers behind our success: energy and natural resources. Turning to dust is a proverb accurately describing what happens with things over time. If we don't put effort into maintaining a car or a house, sunlight, wind, and rain, and the mechanical wear from their use, slowly but steadily turn them into a pile of rubble that is no longer useful. The term behind this process is called entropy. Or, to use another simple analogy, if we never clean up, at one point, our living or working space will become a useless mess we can't even access, let alone find anything we need. To counteract this perpetual force of destruction, we have to put in hard work. Repainting walls, replacing broken roof tiles, fixing a leaking pipe, and we clean up regularly, some more often than others, before chaos takes over. Nature does the same. After a plant has died, a new one grows out of the ground, turning the disorganized molecules of rotting plant biomass into yet another beautiful and well-organized shoot. What do all these efforts have in common? They require energy. For us to produce and apply the new paint, for the plant to grow, we need fuels to run a factory or food for our body, while the energy for plants is coming from a process called photosynthesis, the ingenious way of nature to turn sunlight into sugar that provides the energy to assemble new branches, leaves, and flowers from molecules available in air and soil, assembling elements like carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, phosphorus, oxygen, iron, and many more into life. It may seem obvious, and clearly it was to our ancestors, but it's neither part of today's common sense nor anywhere represented in standard economic theory. Every time we fight entropy and try to create order, we apply energy to organize matter into more structured forms, the stuff we need and want. If we build a car, we need electricity and heat to convert raw materials into that shiny piece of human ingenuity. We need fuels to drive it and energy for regular maintenance so it doesn't break down. And we even need energy to disassemble the vehicle at the end of its life and dispose of or recycle the parts. If we want two cars instead of one, the energy needed is roughly twice as much. We can become a little bit better at building cars as we improve our manufacturing process, or slightly more efficient at retrieving or converting raw materials. There is, however, no way around using more energy for more units of economic output, irrespective of what kind of more we are doing. Over time, we can document that correlation well. Between 1970 and 2010, total global extraction of natural resources from the planet, fuels, ores, salts, biomass, etc., is estimated to have grown 3.2-fold from 23.7 to 70.1 billion metric tons. During the same period, the size of the world economy, adjusted for inflation, grew 3.4-fold from 18.9 to $65.6 trillion. For one additional unit of gross world product, we needed almost one additional unit of natural resources. When looking at energy, relationships look similar. Final energy use, electricity or transportation fuels like gasoline and diesel, track the size of the world economy the same way as other natural resources. Until the first energy crisis in 1973, primary energy consumption and gross world product were directly correlated. To achieve one more inflation-adjusted dollar of economic output, we needed 10.7 megajoules of primary energy. After energy suddenly became more expensive, we slightly reduced the overall primary energy use per unit of gross world product between 1973 and 2000 to around 7.9 megajoules by improving processing efficiency, particularly in electricity generation and the production of bulk materials like steel, aluminum, and copper. Since the year 2000, our improvements have slowed down, as fewer large efficiency gains are left, and globalization has added more transportation needs to the economy. To achieve the same level of economic output next year, we expect to need 0.997 units of this year's energy. Should we continue at the same pace, doubling the global economy between 2015 and 2050, which means 2% real growth every year, requires approximately 1.9 times, or 190%, of today's energy. This is if we are accurately accounting for economic output and inflation and are not overstating growth numbers. For individual economies, these relationships are a lot weaker, as globalization has moved the majority of primary resource processing to low-cost countries. As we have shifted from manufacturing things ourselves to importing energy and natural resources as parts of goods produced elsewhere, many advanced economies seem to become more energy and resource efficient on paper, when in fact they are not. Where does all that energy come from? In 2014, over 90% of the energy used by humans is driven by past and present photosynthetic plant growth. In 2014, total global energy consumption was 13,147 megatons of oil equivalent, where a small part, 5%, originated from growing plant biomass, and the largest portion, 85%, from fossil fuels like coal, natural gas, and oil that represent nothing but ancient biomass stored underground during the past 500 million years. For this conversation, it is important to understand that the sun fuels over 95% of all energy used on planet Earth, as wind and hydropower are equally driven by heat from the sunshine moving air and water. The only sources that didn't require solar contributions during the past billion years are nuclear power, amounting to approximately 4.6% of global primary energy production in 2014, and geothermal energy with 0.05%. While during the industrial age, economic growth has mainly been attributed to our human prowess and ingenuity, we ignored that without fossil solar power, it would simply have been impossible to convert all those natural resources into houses, cars, planes, and mobile phones. What's disturbing is that we are consuming those fossil fuel stores of coal, natural gas, and oil at a breathtaking rate. Each year, we approximately use the quantity that it took around 4.5 million years to form. Or after 7 seconds into January 1 of each new year, we have used up what our planet took an entire year to produce. And all this energy was almost free for us during the past 250 years. We used and still use fossil energy for all the things we do today. We extract minerals like copper, iron, or silicon from the ground. We refine them and turn them into products like building materials, machinery, or computers. We transport these around the globe and travel ourselves. We build, maintain, and heat work and living spaces. Also, we use the same fossil energy to grow food, as we have long moved away from simply growing what is possible on a plot of land without fossil inputs. Current sunlight isn't enough to feed all 7 billion humans. All these inputs are also used to create renewable energy infrastructure. Solar panels, wind turbines, and batteries are mostly built today by using fossil fuels to extract and convert natural resources into final products. So far, we have achieved little on that front. The share of fossil fuels in global energy consumption has dropped from 88% in 1985 to 86% in 2015. Ironically, to accelerate that, we would need even more fossil fuels in absolute terms. Chapter 3. Energy and resource limits are now inhibiting growth. The end of economic growth has been predicted repeatedly throughout the past 250 years, but never before has it been a present reality. Quite the contrary, whoever cried wolf was later defeated by further growth. These sometimes premature warnings have the effect that, today, nobody is listening. But now the situation is different. As growth is ending nearly everywhere despite our frantic attempts at reviving it, and economic limits are becoming a real threat for a growing number of people on our planet, unless a miracle changes that trajectory, this won't go away, but will only accelerate. Why is that so? If we wanted to meet even the modest target of 2% global economic growth per annum for the next 35 years, by the year 2050, we would have to double our resource consumption from today. Instead of using around 82 billion metric tons in 2015, we would consume about 164 billion tons in 2050. Total energy consumption, if improved at the recent rate of 0.3% per annum, would grow by 90% from today's 13,147 million tons of oil equivalent to around 25,000 MTOE. And if we keep introducing renewable energy at the pace of the past 10 years, fossil fuel consumption would grow by 85%, reducing the share of fossil fuels from 86% in 2014 to only around 83 to 84% in 2050. All this assumes we will improve our resource and energy efficiency at the same rate we did recently. We don't report paper growth, and no miracle breakthrough in energy occurs. We are aware of all those very ambitious objectives to improve global energy and resource efficiency, but so far, there are no indications these miracles are happening and can happen without affecting economic growth. But these are all just calculations. We are ready to bet that the global economy of 2050 will be smaller than today's in real terms and not bigger. There are three key developments that will cause this, unless that proverbial miracle happens. The diminishing marginal productivity of new resource exploration, limits on economic benefits of consumption, and credit limits. When extracting fossil energy and other natural resources, we don't really pay for everything that makes them available to us. We don't pay for the geological processes that have concentrated and enriched minerals in a way that make it affordable to unearth them, and we don't pay for most of the damage we do when mining them, nor the damage we create when we dispose of waste. We primarily pay for finding, extracting, enriching, and transporting them to their point of final use. But on all these fronts, we are fighting an uphill battle. Extracting oil from the ocean in reservoirs up to 30,000 feet deep is obviously more difficult than drilling a hole on land where oil just seeps from rocks close to the surface, and mining copper from deposits that contain only a tiny fraction of the shiny metal makes us move and crush much more rock and create much more landscape damage. Numerous examples exist where we increase the effort to get additional, less rich mines and fields into production. To stick with copper, in 2015 it was produced from ores with 0.65% copper content globally, an all-time low. In U.S. mines, ore grades were even lower, around 0.4%. So, the more we want to extract, the more effort is needed to tap into lower quality marginal sources, which reduces economic benefits. How small or big those benefits become from using natural resources largely depends on the efforts required to obtain them. The more we have to invest into getting the inputs, the less will be left for running the machine of industrialized societies. With increasingly lower marginal benefits from newly mined sources, our economies are bound to become smaller, not bigger. Fossil fuels and their usability to convert high-quality natural resources into useful goods has enabled our current lifestyle. To imagine the process we have been experiencing, we can use the analogy of invisible helping hands assisting us in whatever we do. Just like a draft animal uses additional solar energy from grazing to improve crop output on a farm, a machine doing work for us in a factory channels past solar energy, in the form of fossil fuels, to support a lifestyle we could never accomplish with our bare hands or the help of a mule. During the first 200 years after the Industrial Revolution, many of those benefits went into the creation of infrastructure that truly furthered more growth. Machines, factories, railroads, roads, telecommunications networks, better housing for everyone, better hospitals and schools were investments into the ability to create more economic output. During the past decades, though, we have increasingly shifted away from investment towards consumption. In the U.S., for example, the GDP share of household consumption rose from 58% in 1970 to 69% in 2015. Buying more clothes than our closet can hold, having more toys than our kids can ever play with, getting a new smartphone every year, or having that bigger house or car that just feels better but does essentially the same as the previous one, are only creating value, measured as GDP, when they get manufactured and purchased, but not afterwards. That way, we are increasingly shifting away from the creation of multipliers to one-off benefits. It is like if we tried to keep a fire going with matches alone. On top of the physical limits we are experiencing, we are facing further headwinds from financial markets. As a side effect of increasing consumption over investment, almost all economies have grown their financial obligations much faster than their income, measured as GDP. This is as if your own family gets deeper into debt each year, while your income grows much more slowly. And that's exactly what has happened. On average, each household, each country, and each company today owes more relative to their income compared to 30 or 40 years ago. It is very hard to imagine that we can continue growing debt levels, particularly because we are already experiencing the lowest interest rates in history. Those low interest rates give us more room to breathe by reducing the debt service burden. In the United States, households have already experienced these limits since the financial crisis of 2008, and overall credit availability for private individuals has shrunk. But without growing debt, the ability to invest and consume remains limited. Many people hope that rising prices of natural resources and energy will benefit a transition to renewable energy sources. So far, introducing wind and solar, the two most relevant renewable alternatives, has only happened in places with large subsidies or government mandates or at least some imbalance in cost attribution of the overall system. For example, people who produce solar electricity on their roof at a rate that compares favorably to the power charged by their utility receive the reliability of the power grid for free, giving them as much electricity as needed at times when their solar panels don't produce enough. Often, their utility is also buying back excess solar energy at above market prices. This works well as long as only a few households have solar panels. Once everyone produces their own power when the sun shines, getting grid services for free is no longer feasible. This is only one example. In general, we have, despite commitments to the contrary, been notoriously bad at adding renewable technologies. So far, in every year except for 2009, when the global economy and thus energy use shrank by 2%, total fossil fuel consumption grew faster than renewable energy use. If we continue to add renewable energy sources at the pace of the past 15 years, we will only reduce the share of fossil fuels from 86% of global raw, primary energy consumption in 2015 to about 83-84% by 2050. If we try to do more, we will face problems with scaling up that will also impact the ability of our economy to grow. What is taking place today is rather simple. If we think back to our initial example of a farm, we are doing almost everything we can to increase crop output, but we are no longer harvesting heaps more every year as we used to. We can make big efforts, such as bringing in the latest machinery, even more fertilizer or more helping hands in order to squeeze out a little bit, but at a high cost and with unsatisfying results. And now, they are even taking some of our fancy tools and machines away. Since the year 2000, nothing has been normal in economics, because we are at the point where growth becomes almost impossible. Compare it with when you have stretched a rubber band to its maximum length. Pulling it farther becomes harder as the force against your pull is strengthening. And it is only a matter of which will give. You, because the rubber is stronger, or the band when it snaps. The best alternative is to recognize the situation and reduce the pull. That, however, is difficult, because when planning our future, we have always been used to looking at the past for guidance. This has been great advice for most of human history, as throughout 99.9% of our 200,000 years on this planet, except for the past 250, changes have been very slow to arrive, except for sudden events like natural disasters. And in all fairness, those hunters and gatherers who took the beaten path were much more likely to return home compared to the ones venturing into the unknown parts of the jungle, looking for new things and adventures. Thus, during the lifetime of many people, the dominating experience was that next year will likely be better than last, and that economic growth can be taken for granted. It requires true reflection, combined with a reach into our planet's history beyond the year 1750, to understand that our current experience has been shaped by the one-time benefits of burning 500 billion years of solar power that will never return once they are used up. Chapter 4. Why Economic Science Has a Limitless Worldview. 2% is the minimum growth rate predicted by almost every institution for the global economy until the year 2050. While this doesn't sound like much, we now know that 35 years of 2% growth translates into a doubling of economic output, which also almost doubles our energy and resource consumption, at least if we improve our efficiency at the pace of the recent past. There is limited reason to believe that this will change, as we have explained. Now we want to understand how and why economic science got to the impression that we could grow at that or an even faster pace forever. The reason behind this assumption is the same as for us ordinary people. For over 200 years, with only a few short-term bumps, the world economy has indeed been growing at an amazing pace. And with our brains wired to use our recent experience to define rules for the future, it is not surprising that economic theory has come up with a worldview that sees our economic systems expanding forever at high speed. Based on that long-term experience of continuous growth, 20th-century economists revised older economic theories tied to land availability and productivity, which obviously were as finite as available land on our planet, with models built on variables that theoretically had no limits. The most common concept, which is used for almost all relevant economic predictions, is the one driven by the so-called Cobb-Douglas production function. The idea assumes that if we grow two key inputs of production, labor and capital, while improving their productivity, our economic output will grow. Once we understand that more low-cost energy and natural resources are a fundamental requirement to increase economic activity, this worldview comes across as a bit short-sighted. During the past 200 years, when fossil energy and other natural resources were available without limits, and with the continuous improvement in technology and better ways to find and explore new sources and more uses, we had no limits imposed on us from a resource perspective, which is why that simple Cobb-Douglas formula seemed valid, until recently, that is. When dissecting growth more closely over the past centuries, we can conclude that those variables were not representing reality. In scientific terms, labor, capital, and factor productivities largely depend on resource and energy availability and productivity. Or differently put, until there was no limit to energy and natural resources, the Cobb-Douglas equation worked well. Once limits kicked in, we can add humans and capital as much as we like, yet output rises little, if ever, or we get hungry humans and empty factories. This principle is easiest to understand when taking a step back. If there isn't enough food to feed the workers, or enough energy to run the factory, or some resource inputs go missing, there will be no new car, no matter how great workers and factories are. Or, in realistic terms for today's world, if finding the energy and natural resources becomes more cumbersome, it becomes more difficult to add economic output to an already large and complex economic system. Doesn't that sound familiar? Haven't we recently read about big youth unemployment problems around the world, which seems to have no solution? And haven't we also seen that large corporations keep hoarding large amounts of cash or paying it back to shareholders, lacking good investment opportunities? These are just symptoms, but highly indicative that our traditional production function is now limited by its key underlying variables, energy and resource input, and the productivity thereof. Another area where economic theory has erected a dogma based on an incomplete view, driven by an initially correct observation, is the concept of substitution, the ability to switch between different inputs like labor and capital or resources as price and availability changes. While it is plausible and obvious that a buyer reacts to supply shortages or price increases for one good, for example, pork meat, by purchasing an alternative with sufficiently similar properties to satisfy the need for protein, for example, chicken, this rule gets overblown as soon as economists ignore the obvious. Not everything has a meaningful substitute. A few examples. You can't grow plants without water, nitrogen, and phosphorus. And you can't economically erect buildings without some key materials like concrete, timber, steel, copper, aluminum, and many others. After the financial crisis of 2008-2009, enormous efforts were made to counter the downward trend that had led to the global economy shrinking for the first time in more than 60 years, and to restart the growth engine. The objective was to get back on the predicted growth path based on a view ignoring resource and energy inputs. Despite many economic stimulus measures, deficit spending, record low interest rates, and credit guarantees applied to markets or entities requiring support, growth targets were regularly missed. Even today, after 8 years, that growth engine is still sputtering for most. So far, few people in politics, the media, and the corporate world have picked up on that paradox of how little has come from all those unprecedented interventions. Everybody is still hoping for things to get better next year. But unless we find something that eases the pressure on the underlying independent energy and resource variables of our economy, it won't. And as long as we keep ignoring that reality and following economic thinking based on just labor, capital, and their productivity that suggests we can rapidly double the size of our economy, we will only get into more trouble down the road. Some people say lower resource prices, which we have observed since 2015, will support a return to the old normal and are an indication we are actually not facing resource limits. Quite the contrary is true. The heavy price swings for energy and other natural resources since 2008 are a symptom of resource constraints and have detrimental effects on economic stability and investment in mining and extraction. If nobody is ready to invest in new exploration because of the risks, it will become even more difficult to further grow the economy. All it takes to arrive at a more realistic view is to look out for what truly powers an economy and always has. In the old days, before the 20th century, economists understood that we live in a finite system. It is the capacity of the land we live on that determines how wealthy we can get. For a short time, probably a few more decades if we are lucky and use less than projected, we can continue to harness prehistoric land productivity of hundreds of millions of years to fuel our lifestyle, in the form of fossil fuels. But further expansion is difficult, and as soon as we have to go back to a world of land productivity based on current solar inputs, the limits we are talking about will become obvious. Economic theory must retrace its historic roots to be meaningful for this future. Chapter 5. What options are left in a growth-constrained future? Moving forward, we need a miracle to accomplish significant economic growth, particularly if we want growth that isn't just showing in the numbers of top earners, but is felt by most people. This will be next to impossible, and so far, despite all those extraordinary efforts made, it hasn't worked, as most people are not benefiting from the little growth still achieved in some places. So by now, not only have we already experienced almost a decade of economic unpleasantries, but equally, no data we analyzed provides hope that growth will return to the way it used to be. We are fighting against growing extraction efforts for natural resources and energy, and an economy that has exhausted its potential to incur more debt. At the same time, we are also at the beginning of one of the biggest transitions in the past 250 years. Away from fossil fuels and back to renewable energy sources, mostly back to sunlight in all its variations. The biggest challenge, after such a long period where we experienced growth, is accepting that, most likely, no one in the future will ever be as rich as we were during the past decades, particularly in advanced economies. Part of accepting is to understand that, even after scaling back, we will still be among the richest humans of all times, and that living with less, as much as the thought might hurt, does not affect our well-being unless we pick a fight. The trouble is that fighting is the initial reaction most people have when they see their economic future being challenged. There is a big urge to find someone who is guilty. And as we see in many countries, the political discussion is already showing signs of increasing tension and blaming particular groups for our lack of progress. The biggest downside of this dynamic, by trying to find scapegoats and people to blame for what's going wrong, we lose our ability to think clearly about what can be done to change the situation. Once we have dug in and have found our enemies, our brain tends to ignore reality and no longer looks for real solutions that could make the situation better. This is something behavioral scientists call confirmation bias. By ignoring facts that don't fit our position, we make things worse. No matter if we aim at individuals, groups, or other countries, unresolved conflict has never improved the world. Many people share our assessment that the days of fossil energy are numbered, and some even actively want to end the use of coal, oil, and natural gas sooner because of their negative impacts on the environment. We don't take sides in this argument, but are confident that there is no way to phase out fossil energy and replace it with renewable sources without adjusting our economies. Downward, that is. Does this mean we shouldn't invest in and research renewable energy technologies? Absolutely not. We urgently need to find out how to power our societies in the best possible way without fossil fuels in the not-so-distant future once they become unaffordable. The only thing we must accept is that this greener, future world will not work the same way as it does today. For all we know so far, shrinking economies are the most likely scenario. For the lowest 20% of U.S. households, their 2014 income, when corrected for inflation, are back to mid-1970s levels. If inflation on core essentials like housing, energy, food, education, and health are considered, they probably are closer to the mid-1960s. Obviously, nobody should ask those households to scale back even further. But for others, who have grown accustomed to a lifestyle with a much larger footprint, with multiple cars, large houses with TVs in every room, international travel, and a new phone every year, there is change in store. There are three ways to respond. We can passively wait for reality to kick us back. You remember that rubber band. We can fight it and get into real trouble by making it snap, or we can accept this new reality and gradually change to a future that can be satisfactory for everyone. There is enough evidence from around the world that people from countries with far less disposable income than in the U.S. or in Europe are as happy or even happier than those in the richest of countries. What is essential for humans isn't so much to have all these bells and whistles we have grown accustomed to, but rather the ability to feel safe, to have all necessities like food, shelter, energy, healthcare, and education covered, and to have a purpose. As a rule of thumb, there is no correlation between income and happiness in economies where average incomes rise above $10,000. Therefore, backtracking on our growth path isn't necessarily bad. A return to the consumption levels of 1970 wouldn't hurt the well-being of the top 80% of U.S. households in the least. If done deliberately and with care, quite the contrary is true. Giving up the struggle for more material wealth each year can be a huge relief. Chapter 6. Living with less can mean a better life. In the first chapters, we have delivered a sobering message. Economic growth is already absent for most, and more economic stress is coming our way. Finally, we are getting to the upbeat part, shaping our lives in a way that we no longer need growth to be happy. If, as a reader, you don't belong to a household of the lowest income bracket, take an honest look around you, and you will likely see a lot of things you don't truly need to be happy. Be it the latest version of your smartphone, the second car in the driveway, those extra bedrooms that are empty most of the year, all those gadgets in the kitchen, or those toys in the kids' rooms. And how many of those clothes in your closet have you worn during the past 12 months? If it's more than half, you're already doing very well. You most probably agree. Now, there is another part of us, a little person inside our head who strongly disagrees with this point of view. He is small and can silently get grumpy if our neighbor has a new shiny car in the driveway, or if the family across the street tells us about the great vacation in a fancier resort than the one we went to. And she can also become very hooked on the latest smartphone, that 70-inch TV, or the new sneakers her favorite singer wore for the Grammy Awards ceremony, even though last year's purchase would serve us just fine. But when we finally get these things, he or she briefly becomes very excited and happy on that flash of rising dopamine levels in the brain, only to want something else soon after, once the novelty is worn off. That little person, capable of throwing toddler-like temper tantrums that can overpower our rational thinking, is one of the key reasons why we are running on such a high level of consumption, why we have to have so many things. On an evolutionary perspective, it has a lot in common with why male peacocks have those beautiful feathers. They are utterly unnecessary, but demonstrate health, good genes, and excess food resources, and are therefore important ways to show that we are good at finding food and defending our territory. In our modern times of excess resource availability from fossil fuels, that aspiration for more has gone into spinning mode, burning rubber rather than providing traction. But by consuming way beyond our needs, we still satisfy that old urge to demonstrate status and comparative fitness. With a world of less in front of us, we have to give this little person in our heads new directions, or he or she will be grumpy all the time, seducing us to make more bad decisions or finding scapegoats to blame. But how does that work? Below, we will provide a few examples that not only reduce long-term financial burdens, but also provide the same or even larger amounts of happiness compared to the lifestyle that has evolved over the past century. It follows three key principles. 1. Evaluate true need versus want before buying something, even if you can afford it. Be proud of it. 2. Avoid credit and pay later options whenever you can. Enjoy your purchases without remorse. 3. Find rewards without huge cost to your wallet and resource use. You will be loved. Let's look at needs and wants first. When did you buy your last cell phone? Your current car? Was it because the old one was broken beyond repair, or because a newer version promised features your previous one didn't have? Were these features really required? And that last gadget, garment, or accessory that made it into your collection, was that a purchase that mostly made you feel good in the very moment, or a true necessity that made a change to your everyday life ever since? If you take a step back on all these things and are honest with yourself, you probably, in many cases, will have to admit that a true need wasn't the driver behind a majority of purchases, but rather a want. And if you manage to take a further step back on the subject, you will soon recognize that many needs are wants in disguise. If you're in want territory, think again and wait another day, or find an alternative way to get yourself that dopamine kick. Believe us, you feel as rewarded once you get hooked on the feeling of not having spent money on something useless. And never, to lead to the next principle, never buy wants going into debt. Whatever want you buy on credit has two disadvantages. In most cases, the joy of the moment is long gone by the time you are done paying it off. Further, credit inevitably makes buying something more expensive compared to a cash purchase, because someone wants to be compensated for lending you money and often also wants to take advantage of your impulse to have it right now. We do not say that credit is always wrong. There are situations where its careful use can enable things that truly benefit you and your family. For example, buying a house. Or, in a difficult situation, credit can help secure necessities, cover true needs, and bridge gaps. When buying stuff with cash you have already earned, even if it's something unnecessary, that dopamine burst of being rewarded is, we promise, much bigger compared to the one that is burdened by the nagging feeling that this purchase will require paying it off way into the future. We explained it before. What we as humans seek in most of our unnecessary purchases and gifts to others is the rise in dopamine, a neurotransmitter that lightens our mood and makes us happier. The same goes for our kids when they get their 500th toy. This is why a mall visit is also called shopping therapy. If we want to give up on that habit, We have to find different ways. And the good news is, how you feel mostly depends on the targets you're defining. If you decide your goal is to avoid many wants in the future, your brain is capable of turning a victory over your impulse, that little toddler in your brain, into a high dopamine kick, giving you a broad smile. Did you know that hiding a little love note under your significant other's pillow creates the same positive dopamine rush for both of you as an expensive surprise present? Did you know that children are usually happier after you spend time with them doing a self-designed treasure hunt in the garden, a nearby park, or a forest, compared to a visit to a theme park? There are many ways to get those dopamine levels up without spending a dime or wasting natural resources. Visit www.energyandstuff.org for more ideas. Back to the needs. Buying big stuff is the largest burden on your wallet, but also a place where much can be saved. Let's move ahead with an example that shows our train of thought. Buying a car. Nowadays, most people don't buy. They finance or lease, the first place that adds more cost compared to a cash purchase. This starts with a significant down payment and subsequent monthly installments, typically for 4 to 6 years. After that, they return the car or trade it for a newer model. Mostly, the end of that financing cycle is by no means equal to the end of the life of the vehicle. Typically, if there is no accident totaling a car permanently, it can last 20 years or more, depending on brand, maintenance, and miles driven. When it comes to truly relevant features like safety and comfort, a 10-year-old vehicle doesn't lack anything major compared to a brand new one. There might be a few gadgets missing, and you can't run it on autopilot while watching a movie in the back seat, something you shouldn't be doing anyway. But other than that, it's perfectly fine and safe to drive. So if you buy a new or almost new car next time using your savings with the intent of keeping it for 10 years, you will easily save 30% of the overall cost without any noticeable downside. The same applies to your next cell phone. There are many ways to both save money and resources without giving up on anything important on functionality and style. Last but not least, one of the biggest problems we are currently facing going into a future of less is the reluctance of politicians to accept that something has fundamentally changed, and to keep promising that their particular policy recipe will bring growth back for all of us. To our knowledge, there isn't any relevant policymaker who openly admits that we might have reached the end of the ladder and that we should get ready to scale back to lower wealth levels, which, by the way, will still be close to the highest in human history. Not even the new anti-establishment politicians that spring up on either side of the political spectrum are presenting that message, but instead tell us of their unique approach that will bring back growth for all of us. Unfortunately, they would be facing the same problems. Their magic just hasn't been tested yet. However, it is important to know that most politicians haven't chosen to ignore this because they are mean or stupid. They do this because they think that you, their voters, want to hear a message that involves the word growth. It might be upon you to tell them that this is not the case, and that you, instead of being treated to a wealth of missed promises that disenfranchise more and more people, would prefer to be guided towards a good life with what we have today, where society isn't torn apart by the conflict emerging from a futile attempt to obtain more and more every year. This audiobook was provided by IIER. If you liked it, please share it with others and visit www.energyandstuff.org to learn more and to support our work.